She's a woman determined to break what she calls the highest, hardest glass ceiling, to achieve a political office that until now has only been occupied by men. She's come this far through tireless campaigning, helped, say her critics, by the famous name she acquired from her politician husband. We're talking, of course, about Hillary Clinton, who will be formally nominated by this week's Democratic Party convention as their candidate for President of the United States. But it's also a description that could apply just as easily to another American woman and political pioneer from a century ago, which is why we're here on St. James's Square in central London, in front of number 4, which is a very grand 18th century London townhouse. We'll go through the porticoed entrance. It is now the Naval and Military Club, past the bust of King Edward VII, and up the sweeping staircase. And to imagine this was a private home, it would have had to have been somebody of extraordinary wealth. As we come up to the first landing, not one, but I think two ballrooms. So who lived here? Well, on hand to answer that question is Jackie Turner from Reading University, which holds the archive of the person we're talking about. And Jackie Turner, we're in a room here. There's a fireplace. It's very high-ceilinged. Who did it belong to?
We're actually in a bedroom, and it's a very impressive bedroom. And it belonged to Nancy Astor, Lady Nancy Astor, who was the wife of Viscount Lord Astor.
So Nancy Astor, just tell us more about who she is.
She's a very unusual character, actually. She's a member of the aristocracy, but she isn't British. She's actually American. She's the wife of Lord Astor, who is one of the richest men in Britain. They're actually one of the richest families in the world. They own the press. They're part of the establishment.
But Nancy Astor, American-born, she would have been a society wife presiding over this very grand house. Just under a century ago, there have been some big changes politically.
From 1918, we see huge changes in British democracy. We see working-class men coming back from World War I and getting the vote for the first time, and we see this partial female franchise. In addition, there's a very small and sneaky little piece of legislation, which is the Parliamentary Qualification of Women Act, and that means that women can now stand for Parliament in their own right for the first time. And this is critical to Nancy, because the surprising news comes, Waldorf Astor's father has died. The first Viscount Astor has died. And this means that Waldorf, Nancy's husband, is forced to relinquish his seat in the House of Commons to take his seat in the House of Lords as the second Viscount Astor, which left a huge hole in the constituency of Plymouth Sutton. And then the question was asked, who could actually fill those shoes?
So that's the question before the electors of Plymouth Sutton. And on hand to give us this dispatch of political news, a voice familiar to Radio 4 listeners as someone who does bring us the news, Cathy Clugston, you have that.
The Executive Council of the Unionist Association at Plymouth decided yesterday to recommend the association to adopt Lady Astor as candidate in the by-election caused by her husband's succession to the peerage. Our Plymouth correspondent telegraphs, Lady Astor will be a popular candidate with a large section of the electorate. She took a very prominent part in the election last December when her husband was kept away by official duties. Though it remains to be seen how a woman's candidature will be received, there is no doubt that on the ground of personal popularity, Lady Astor will have a very good chance if she decides to stand.
So that account from the Times of the political speculation now that Waldorf Astor is going to give up his seat. The right moment to bring in Gary Gerstle, who is the Mellon Professor of American History at Cambridge University. We're talking right now about Hillary Clinton, nominee for president, but she first reached prominence in US national life as the First Lady in the 1990s.
Yes, her husband was Bill Clinton, who won the election in 1992, was re-elected in 1996, and she was determined to be a different kind of first lady from anyone who had ever occupied the White House before. And so Hillary, during the presidency, was going to be a co-president of Bill Clinton's. They announced this in 1992. He gave her a lot of authority in the White House the first couple years, and it had been an utter disaster.
It's this death in the family that leads to Nancy Astor's husband having to vacate his seat in the Commons. What, though, Gary Gerstle, is the opening that comes for Hillary Clinton to move from being First Lady to a politician in her own right?
Desolation. She has discovered in 1998 that Bill had been having an affair with Monica Lewinsky, the White House intern. The House of Representatives has voted articles of impeachment. The Senate was meeting in February 1999 to decide whether to convict him, and if convicted, to remove him from office. And at this moment, she is meeting with Harold Ickes, longtime Democratic Party strategist, to decide whether she's going to throw in her hat to run for the senator from New York, the seat just having been made vacant by the announced retirement of Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
And why does she think that, because of what's happened in her personal life, that a political career of herself as candidate is somehow a solution?
I think it's partly for her own self-regard. She is shattered. Bill had lied to her for 7 months, insisting this was not the case. So it's partly for her own integrity, a way of going forward, but it's also a declaration of independence from Bill that she is finally going to be her own woman. She is no longer going to be second fiddle to him. She is no longer going to be dependent on his wayward ways.
What about back then with Nancy Astor, Jackie Turner? How do people react to the idea of her as a candidate?
It's mixed. It's largely negative, but there are pockets of immense support from her. And most importantly, she's the candidate for Plymouth, and she is so well-liked in Plymouth.
And well-known. But some of the reaction takes particular exception to the fact that she's a woman. And, Cathy Clugston, you have a celebrity verdict on her as a candidate. Who's that?
Well, this is a private letter written to Nancy Astor by her friend, the novelist J.M. Barrie. And he says, "I hear of your presumptuous ambitions at Plymouth. How any woman can dare stand up against a man, I don't understand. What can you know about politics? These things require a man's brains, a man's knowledge, a man's fairness, a man's eloquence. Woman's true sphere in life is to be a respectful helpmeet."
I mean, it seems jaw-dropping to us now, Jackie Turner. This is just kind of overt sexual discrimination, saying, as a woman, forget whatever other talents or merits she might have, she's not qualified to be an MP.
And there is an argument there that she didn't have those qualifications to be an MP. But what she did have was she had the common touch and she had Waldorf. And in political circles, it was always felt that she would be under his control.
And what about the overt sexism we heard voiced there by J.M. Barrie, saying, oh, it doesn't matter what woman she is, the fact that she's a woman makes her unqualified in the case of Nancy Astor. Was there straightforward sexism, misogyny directed at Hillary Clinton in that first bid?
I think there was some, especially from more conservative sectors, by people who never liked her. Her negatives were already very high, and a lot of that had to do with the misogynistic streak in the American population, a sense that Hillary was doing something that a true woman should not have done and was violating true womanhood in the process.
And what about the name? How important was the Astor name, Jackie Turner?
The Astor name meant a great deal. Locally in Plymouth, because they'd invested in civic projects that actually bore their name. As a family, they were very, very much ensconced in Plymouth. And they kept a home in Plymouth. They lived there. And that made a great deal of difference to local voters. On a much wider, on a more national scale, again, the Astor name was very important. It was a real establishment name.
Gary Gerstle, what about the Clinton name?
For elective office, critical. Interesting hypothetical. What would Hillary Rodham have done had she not been married to Bill? She would have been enormously successful in some pursuit of life. She would not have been a politician. She was not a natural politician like Bill was. She was not a natural campaigner. None of it came easily to her as it did for him. So her very presence in politics, especially in electoral politics, was due to the fact that she was married to Bill Clinton, the President of the United States.
Now, we heard in the words of J.M. Barrie that sexism was obviously going to be part of this campaign, but there were some who thought a woman brought certain advantages to the table, including the then Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. And Cathy Clugston, you have that.
So this is a message of support that Lloyd George sent to Lady Astor. "Now that women have been enfranchised, I think it's important that there should be a certain number of women in Parliament in order to represent the woman's point of view. There are a good many questions in regard to housing, children, welfare, food, drink and prices, in which it would be an immense advantage, both to the nation and the House of Commons, to have a woman's view presented by a woman."
Gary Gerstle, really interesting to hear what David Lloyd George saw as being women's issues, housing, children, welfare. What was the portfolio of issues that Hillary Clinton had become known for in the 1990s?
She had become known for healthcare, bringing America national health insurance for the first time. She stayed away from women's issues. She wanted to be one of the players, and she wanted to be the equal of men in all respects. And so that meant subduing the domestic portfolio, we might say. After 1994, when her efforts to be the czar of the healthcare plan, which crashes and discredits Clinton, she retreats to the place where Lloyd George said women should retreat to. Take care of domestic affairs in public.
So here in this magnificent house on St. James's Square, Nancy Astor, about to make the transition from socialite to political candidate, how well does she campaign? That's where our story goes next. We're taking the long view of women in politics, telling the story of Nancy Astor and her campaign to be the first woman in the House of Commons. Jackie Turner, where we left it was that the Tory party have accepted her as the candidate, and in news terms, this is going to be a massive story.
It's absolutely huge. This is the making of history. Nancy's potentially going to go into Parliament. And it's huge news in the UK, but it's also huge news in Virginia and in her home county and her home country of the US.
And so the international press come to this country to follow this enormous story, which explains where we've come. We're in the London bureau of CNN, Cable News Network, and here on hand listening to the story of Nancy Astor is none other than CNN's chief international correspondent, Christiane Amanpour. What about today? Global press interest in the prospect of a first woman president of the United States.
Well, absolutely. I mean, nothing could be more exciting, frankly, than a wholesale change of leadership around the world, particularly for us women who have been really lobbying for our own careers, for our daughters' careers, and for our sons to see the kind of role models that are coming into public office right now. And I've always believed that if the president of the most powerful country in the world, which is the United States, happens to be a woman, it will have a huge sort of knock-on, inspirational, trickle-down effect. I do believe that, particularly at a time when we're seeing women in positions of power all over. We've just had only the second female prime minister in British history, Theresa May.
On this question of press interest, it was a huge story, Nancy Astor's candidacy. And for a flavour of that from the Times at the time, Kathy Clugston.
At one of her meetings, Lady Astor made amusing reference to the prominence into which she had emerged. She said that one of the most terrifying things in standing for Parliament is the press, and that it is a horrible thing all of a sudden to find yourself a public character suddenly shot into the forefront of the women of England.
Now, that won't come as news to many women politicians who feel it is a pretty bruising ordeal facing the press in full fury. What was her press coverage like, Jackie Turner? Was the press supportive of her or unkind?
It was mixed. There was an awful lot of bad press that particularly came from the Times. But you can marry that against the fact as actually a lot of the Astor wealth came from the fact that they owned a large tract of the press.
They owned the Observer, for example.
Absolutely. So when you look in the Observer, Nancy's press is much more gentle and it's much more supportive.
OK, so what about this press coverage of Hillary Clinton? That complaint there from Nancy Astor, one of the most terrifying things in running, she would say, is the press. That would surely be something Hillary Clinton would say about her own press treatment.
I think you're absolutely right. I think Hillary Clinton has had a different kind of press treatment than she would have had if she was a male. And I believe that that is the case for many, many female politicians. If you look at the leading tabloid in Britain, they have decided to mark our second ever female prime minister with a kitten heel and a silly sexist headline like Heel Boys. You know, really? Is that the way we want to mark it?
A reference to Theresa May's footwear.
Theresa May's footwear instead of her professionalism and her experience for the job.
Jackie Turner.
Yes, I just wanted to pick up on what you said about the kitten heel, because the biggest thing about the press and those early female MPs was it was all about their dress. And Nancy developed almost a uniform, if you like, of a plain black suit, a white collar and a tricorn hat.
Let's bring in Kate Andrews, who speaks for Republicans overseas here in the UK. What about this press hostility to Hillary Clinton? Is it just the normal rough and tumble of politics, or is there something particular about the fact that she's a woman?
Over the years, I don't think anyone could doubt that Hillary Clinton and many other women in politics have been treated unfairly because of their gender. However, we are getting to an uncomfortable point in the press that Hillary Clinton herself is pushing, where certain things are just off limits. And when you are running for the president of the United States, and we are talking about likability or unfavorability numbers, it is completely legitimate to bring up her shortcomings. And they're not doing it because she's a woman. They're doing it because, truthfully, she has some very very serious problems with her political past, and she has problems with being trustworthy with her current audience now.
So let's talk about these women on the campaign trail. And Kathy Closen, you have an account, again, I think from the Times, of Nancy Astor in the mode of campaigning politician on the stump.
The amazing energy of Lady Astor continues to be a feature of the by-election. Few hands were raised in favour of this woman candidate when she addressed a meeting of weather-beaten fishermen yesterday. "What? Not going to vote for me?" she retorted. "Well, never mind. Your wives will, even if you don't."
So quite feisty on the campaign trail, Jackie Turner.
She was absolutely brilliant on the hustings. That's where she was at her best. Her wit, her repartee, and I think this is where the fact that she's an American comes into it as well. She doesn't have those same constraints that a lot of aristocratic British women has. She gets involved, she gets her hands dirty, and she talks to people. She has a wonderful line in repartee. There's one occasion on the hustings in Plymouth where she's being heckled by a man and someone rolls a cabbage at her. She picks it up and in that very, very slight Virginian accent sort of says, "Look here, that man's lost his head."
So she's quick, she's witty, quite charismatic on the stump. Christian Amanpour, how would you match that description with the description of Hillary Clinton as a campaigner?
Well, you all know that she is characterised as stiff, you know, as a campaigner. Many people who have met her personally and actually interviewed, I have interviewed her before, and she's not really like that one-on-one. She's very, very different one-on-one. And it is a little bit odd as to why that more relaxed, you know, more personable, witty Hillary Clinton doesn't come across as often.
I want to bring up one moment of campaigning, a famous moment in the 2008 race. It changed a lot of people's attitudes to her during the New Hampshire primary, and it is a kind of moment charged with this gender question. And Gary Gerstel, I think you know the moment I mean, when Hillary Clinton seemed to break down in tears at one moment. Describe for us what happened there and its significance.
Hillary had lost to Barack Obama in Iowa, had been a great shock. She expected to walk into the nomination, and she put on her very serious look and she hunkered down. And then she began getting all this criticism for being hard-hearted as a woman. And finally, in New Hampshire, broke down and cried to elicit sympathy as a woman. And I think it helped her there. We still don't know to this day how premeditated it was. What I will say about her, she's not a natural on the campaign trail, but she's a terrific counterpuncher. In a brawl, she knows how to take care of herself. Her fists are up around her face. She's not going for the jugular in the other person, but if that other person leaves an opening, she will clock him.
Kate Andrews.
I think what's so fascinating about Hillary Clinton, and specifically her age and the time that she's operating in, a lot of young women are looking at her and saying, well, yes, she is a woman, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's at the top of my priority list. And she's struggling in that area. She brought a bunch of prominent feminists with her onto the stage who basically told young women a few months back that they were wrong to not be voting for Hillary Clinton. And it backfired badly.
That's a really interesting point about feminism, because Astor had no feminist support. People of the suffrage movement didn't support her. It's really difficult to find any of those hardline feminists or even those softer feminists of the interwar period who actually supported Astor.
So Nancy Astor is making the case that she is the best candidate to represent Plymouth Sutton in Parliament. Is her campaign, with all those spirited appearances on the stump, going to be a success? And will she make it to Parliament? That's what we're about to find out. We're telling the story of Nancy Astor taking the long view of women in politics. We've made the journey Nancy Astor herself wanted to make. We've come into Parliament in the House of Commons. We're on the committee corridor. We've passed the statues and busts of Gladstone and Disraeli and other parliamentary greats. Jackie Turner, when we left Nancy Astor, she was campaigning with great vim in Plymouth, desperate to win her own place here in this building. What happened?
Well, she won. And she won by a good majority. She won by 5,000 in that first election. And she found herself here in Parliament to the cheers of not only her constituency and the women in constituency, but her women at large.
And to commemorate that, we are standing opposite on this committee corridor a plaque which commemorates this achievement. And Kathy Clugston, tell us what it says.
Yes, it's a rather lovely plaque with a picture of Lady Astor in profile and the dates 1879 to 1964. And underneath is inscribed, on the 1st of December 1919, Nancy Astor became the first woman to sit in Parliament. For nearly 2 years, she was the only woman member of an otherwise all-male assembly. She represented the Sutton Division of Plymouth as a Conservative, retiring in 1945.
And so on hand, looking at this plaque with us with that kind of bas-relief of her face in profile is the Deputy Curator of Parliamentary Art, Melanie Unwin. And Melanie Unwin, just tell us something of the provenance of this plaque and particularly its placing here.
Certainly. As you see, you're looking at a relief sculpture with a profile of Nancy Astor on it by the artist Michael Rosillo. This was presented to Parliament in the mid-1990s by the Astor family. And it was actually installed on its current site actually only this year, earlier this year. And so it's on Committee Corridor where the primary collection of images of Prime Ministers is from the earliest times, Walpole, right through to Churchill. And as you can see, she's opposite Churchill, who, of course, was very much opposed to women being in Parliament, and Nancy Astor quite strongly. And she's also opposite the Lloyd George Room. And Lloyd George, of course, was one of the Prime Minister people who introduced her into the House of Commons.
And in a way, just arriving in Parliament, almost as significant an achievement as becoming Prime Minister, to be the first woman.
I think absolutely, and not only arriving as the first woman, but sitting in that chamber for 2 years as the only woman in a hostile crowd.
We're looking at the plaque, and it does seem quite carefully worded. It says the first woman to sit in Parliament, and there's a reason for that. And to explain that to us, the parliamentary archivist, Mari Takienagi, the wording's very deliberate.
The first woman to be elected to Parliament was Constance Markovitch, and this was in the first general election in which women could vote and which women could stand to be MPs in December 1918. 17 women stood and only one was elected. Constance Markovitch was elected as a Sinn Féin MP for the St Patrick's Division of Dublin. The reason that Nancy Astor was the first to sit, of course, was because as a Sinn Féin MP, Markovitch never took her seat, and that was in common with a lot of other Sinn Féin MPs at the time. And in fact, she was also in prison, which would have made it difficult for her to take her seat as well.
For an account of how this place reacts to its new and female arrival, Cathy Clugston, you have that.
Yes, I have an article here from the Manchester Guardian, dated the 2nd of December 1919. The first woman member yesterday took her seat in the House of Commons amid general applause. It is, after all, a considerable event. Not that Lady Astor is likely to contribute anything very important to the collective wisdom of the House, though she has a shrewd wit and a woman's readiness.
So, Jackie Turner, if we can get beyond what The Guardian could see and actually talk about her record as an MP, what were her issues, how good at the parliamentary business was she?
I think the best way to talk about her performance was mixed. But once she was here, she very much focused on what were considered feminine politics, welfare, families and children.
And some controversial positions she took.
She certainly did. Her maiden speech was on the issue of drink or temperance, which was absolutely Nancy's holy grail. Of course, Nancy Astor was also very erratic in her performance as an MP, especially during the 30s and then through the Second World War. She made some very odd statements. She talked about D-Day dodgers being men who'd served in North Africa and Italy. She was very erratic. She would interrupt people in Parliament. She particularly suffered in the 1930s from accusations of being an appeaser. These were always allegations that she was being part of that Clifton set that dogged Nancy for many years after.
We're talking about Nancy Astor as this great pioneer, and it says on this plaque in front of us that she sat there for 2 years as the only woman in Parliament. Did others follow? A question for the archivist here in Parliament, Mari Takienagi. We know that Nancy Astor was the first. What happened after her?
Nancy Astor was the first woman MP to take her seat, and after nearly 2 years, she was followed by Margaret Winteringham. Margaret Winteringham was a Liberal MP, but she had a similarity to Nancy Astor in that it was because of her husband that she got her seat. In her case, though, it wasn't that he was elevated to the House of Lords, it was that he died. His wife was then asked to stand in his place, and she campaigned without making a speech in the whole election campaign, rather in contrast to Nancy Astor.
So you have those two, and then the subsequent women, are they also wives and widows?
The third one was another wife. This was Mabel Phillipson. She was a Conservative MP, and her husband had stood as a National Liberal. And then he was unseated on election petition in 1923 for electoral fraud. It was his agent rather than him, I should say, that was guilty of the fraud. But he was banned from standing for about 7 years, so his wife was again asked to take the seat. There were 39 women elected in the period that Nancy Astor was an MP, and I've counted at least 14 that had some sort of husband connections.
We're hearing there, 80, 90 years ago, that women coming into Parliament, many of them had a kind of dynastic connection, a family name. People are saying this more and more about American politics today in the 21st century, that it is often a battle of these famous dynasties.
It appears that it is, but it only involves two families, really, the Bushes and the Clintons. I think for a dynasty to take shape, there must be a generational component. I doubt very much there will be one for the Clintons. The bigger issue here is not so much a political dynasty, but the amount of money required to be successful in politics and the kind of networks that have to be established in order to effectuate political success. And those sums are so huge that once the networks are established by one member of a family, there is a tendency to try and keep that going just because the machine has been built and can be used for other purposes. We see that with Hillary, who's clearly benefiting from the machine that Bill built over the years, but I don't think it will continue beyond Hillary's presidency.
Nancy Astor, the first woman. Hillary Clinton could be the first president. Theresa May, the second prime minister. Is something shifting here? And is there perhaps the significant thing not being the first, but in a way being the second? Kate Andrews.
Well, Nancy Astor once said that she didn't particularly aspire to hold a senior position within Parliament because she thought it would be harder to fight her own party. She was a real individual in that way. And I think fundamentally the difference between her and Clinton and perhaps even Theresa May is that they want to be the party. They want to harness that power. They don't want to be the dissenting voice. They want to be the voice. And in that sense, women certainly do feel these days that they can harness that power, that they can be the leader, and that that's something that they can achieve. You know, I think it's right for all of us to be skeptical, man or woman, of someone who wants power too much. But we are certainly moving into a phase where it's not about being the first. Maybe it's not even about being the second. It's about being the one in control. And women do have that opportunity today, and we are seeing it across the world.
And Jackie Turner, we're talking about Theresa May, who has made it, Hillary Clinton, who hopes to make it. What debt do women like that owe Nancy Astor?
It's very difficult to talk about a debt when there has been such a long time period in between and society has moved on. But we've talked before about the glass ceiling, and I think Nancy's lasting legacy, regardless of her performance as an MP, is the fact that she was the first woman and she did break that glass ceiling. She made the way for those more radical MPs who actually came in after her.
Jackie Turner, Gary Gerstle, Kate Andrews, Melanie Unwin, Mari Takeyanagi, and our reader, Kathy Clugston, from here on the Prime Minister's Corridor in the Houses of Parliament. Thank you all for taking the long view.